In the fabled land of Northern California, nestled in the Valley of Sacramento, two friends begin a journey to enlighten the world about their experience living life as a Xenial. But what is a Xenial, you may ask? If you wish to know, then follow them on their adventures.
Welcome to the Xenial Chronicles. This is James.
This is Mike.
And amazingly, I don't know how it worked out, even with, I know I had some crazy stuff going on this week. Mike didn't, at least not too crazy, because we're actually on Friday night. We're actually doing this at nighttime.
Yes, we are actually doing
this.
Instead
of doing it Sunday morning.
Yeah, we are actually doing this at a proper time after all this time. Like, finally, what is it, the third podcast of the year, and we're like a month in, and we're finally getting to this? It's insane.
Yeah, I came downstairs from my office to dinner tonight. I actually made dinner in my new waffle maker that I got.
Nice.
Got the new waffle maker. Interestingly, you know, in the stores and like especially in Target, but they have them in Walmart too. There's those little tiny like single waffle makers.
And
like,
yeah.
During the holidays, they have different ones that are themed. So like I already have one that's a skull waffle maker, but they do like pumpkins and bats, and
yeah,
they're just
yeah.
like little tiny single round. You make one waffle at a time, which is tedious and annoying to make one waffle at a time, and thus all you're making is one waffle, and then it's great. You know, if you're a lonely person that just lives by yourself. And I have a few of those. The company that makes those is a company called Dash.
Oh, okay.
And my wife found through her various Amazon shopping, which you know, I've been talking to my father lately about various things that he wants to get, introducing him to the idea that anything you want, basically, you can find on the internet. If you know how to search for things.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You can find anything. Now, he lives way up in the middle of nowhere, so he has no real internet connection. He has a cell phone, but the connection is exceptionally spotty and not nearly good enough for him to be able to do any real shopping. Plus, he doesn't know how to phrase searches properly to find
right.
what you're looking for.
That's,
that is,
that's
you
the
need
secret.
Somebody
yeah.
who knows that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the secret, man.
My wife is key at phrasing searches properly. She finds everything that you can possibly want, and things that you don't want, and we still get anyway. And I informed my dad, yeah, if you want us to look for stuff, trust me, the Amazon drivers, they know where my house is. They very well know where my house is. I get shit delivered all the time.
Yeah.
If a week goes by and we don't have an Amazon delivery, I'm sure they'd send somebody over to make sure we're all still alive.
That makes sense.
But anyway,
we kind of do the same
anyway,
over here too.
Yeah. She found this one on Amazon, and it's from the company Dash. And I love those little ones. I have two of the little ones, and they cook up real good. The waffles don't stick. They're really, really nice. She found one that was a standard, you know, like square four square waffle iron. But what's really cool about this one is it's got two grooves on the side. They're like pretty wide. They're like a good half inch to three quarter, no, about a three quarter inch groove on each side of the waffle iron. That's part of the iron. Okay.
Okay.
The purpose of the groove is for the overrun. Cause like when you're doing waffles in a waffle iron, right? You put the batter in and, you know, you cinch it down. You're like, oh, this is goodness. It starts to heat up. You get the overrun squeezing out of the side and it makes a mess on the counter or whatever.
Yep.
This has grooves built into the two sides to actually catch the overrun. That's its entire purpose. So the beauty of that is instead of having to wipe it up off the counter, you have an extra little, especially if you're the cook, you get to pull off the little pieces that do the overrun. You got a little extra snack as you're making waffles for everybody.
That's great. That's great.
It's fantastic. So yeah. We had waffles for dinner tonight. Just waffles. It was amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's really funny because I think at one point we've talked about waffle makers before, and I happened to, I believe I happened to talk to send you a picture. I was out at a GameStop not too yes. long ago, and I sent you a picture apparently of, I didn't know that there was official Dungeons & Dragons merchandise that included coffee makers and waffle yeah. makers, which I thought was yep. great because this thing was a waffle with a 20-sided die in the center of it.
Yeah.
I thought awesome. That was great. Yeah. I thought that was fantastic. Awesome. I knew you'd have got a kick out of that.
Mine was actually in transit to get here when you sent me that picture.
That's funny. That's why you said that was hilarious. I remember you responded to it. You said it was pretty damn funny.
Yeah, just one of those apropos moments for you to send me that. But anyway, I was going downstairs to mix up waffle batter, let it sit in the fridge. Because by the way, in case you don't know, people listening, the best way to get really good, nice, fluffy on the outside and crunchy on the fluffy on the inside, crunchy on the outside. Gotta get it right. Waffles.
Yeah.
Is to make sure your batter is cold.
Mm-hmm.
You want to use cold water. I use I have a fridge that's got a nifty little water pitcher inside that you can it's got a little infuser built in, so you can infuse stuff in the water, or you can just have water that's even colder than what comes out of the door.
Yeah,
and so I use that to do my waffle mix, and then I put my waffle mix in the fridge for usually about 15-20 minutes before I make waffles, because I like my mix nice and cold. It makes better waffles. And don't overmix your waffle mix either. You don't want to mix it too much. You it's not like pancakes where you want to make sure all the lumps are out. A few lumps are okay, cause you're going to let it sit for a little while. But it's very much like making, sugar cookies. If you make sugar cookies, you need to let those sit in the, refrigerator before you actually make the cookies and then put them in the oven.
Definitely.
Yeah, made some nice waffles, but as I was coming downstairs, my wife looks over at me and she goes, "So you podcasting tonight?" I'm like, "Well, that's the plan." Mike said yes, but we got 2 hours until then, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows what other crazy shit was going to go down before we did this? And I didn't trust it anymore. I've stopped trusting the reliability of podcasting, of us putting this together on Friday nights. I've stopped trusting it.
Me too, and especially as things were hitting this week, we have a child that's sick that we're waiting on a COVID test again. So fun for that new variants of COVID.
Oh,
waiting
man.
To see what happens with the test. Luckily, he's the only one that's sick at this point, and he's not that bad sick, but he is like the whole man flu thing. He's like man flu times three.
I gotcha. Okay, so he's like really feeling it.
No, he's not feeling it. He's just bitching about it over and over and over again. But anyway, he's still eating food. He's still drinking. He's still talking. He's just coughing and feeling like garbage. So, I mean, he's all right at this point. But, if it is COVID, then no work for me, at least physically going into the office. No school for the other kids. Everybody's staying home. And then, of course, as I told you earlier, having issues with my beautiful, beautiful car. My Mini is in the shop right now trying to get work done on it.
Yeah.
So, it was that craziness that starts hitting me this week. And that was hitting kind of yesterday. I was like, oh, great. We're not going to hit it. But we did. We made it to the podcast. We made it to Friday night to do the podcast. We even have research that Mike did on something we discussed after we recorded the podcast on Sunday that we're going to tell you about a musical find of his with both of our journey on record collection.
Yeah.
I know I sent you pictures of my stuff. I learned something about myself in the last week and a half. It's one of those things where I had said before on here that I would, when I was going to get records, actual albums, the vinyl albums, instead of just, the CDs that I have with download music, whatever, I wanted to get stuff that was records I'd want to listen to, albums I'd want to listen to all the way through, and for bands that really mean something to me. And I found out that there is a band that I thought I only liked in a kind of tertiary level, or not even tertiary, like a little more than that, like a secondary level. They were one of my secondary favorite bands. But it turns out that they are one of my top. I don't like top fives because five's a stupid number. I like sevens. So okay. this is definitely in my top seven of bands. Probably even higher than higher up on that list of top seven.
Right.
And as of today, I have every single one of their albums, which is only six albums of theirs. Six. I have every one of their albums now, as of today, on vinyl. The only other band whose albums I have on vinyl, all of them, is Metallica. That's the only other one.
Oh, wow.
We know how much I love Metallica, and I even have the new Metallica album, 72 Seasons, on, I already paid for it. It's already on pre-order.
So it's on its way.
It'll be April 14th, I think, is when it ships for everybody. So I'm gonna get it then. But the realization as I was thinking about getting these, finding the various albums to get, I paid a whole lot of money for them. Because two of them aren't even, they were bootleg albums from Europe. They're not even from America. They are real. Wow. They're real albums, but they're European albums. So I paid a bunch of money for them. Those ones arrived today, but they played beautifully.
Good.
No problems with them. Beautiful art. You saw the discs. They're nice.
They're gorgeous.
Red.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And their most recent album was the box set that thing came in, the recent album.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that thing is unbelievably massive. But apparently, yeah, Tool is like maybe my second favorite band. I thought it was Volbeat, but apparently I researching and deciding to get all these, I really, really like Tool. Like, really like them. So that's good, I guess. It is one of the bands I still want to see live. Like, you know, that's a definite live bucket list band is Tool. I've seen Metallica a few times. I'd love to see them again, but
I would
definitely need to see Tool.
I'm surprised you haven't seen them yet. I actually got to see them a very long time ago. But my God, it was one of the best shows I'd ever seen in my life.
I've gotten, it was seeing A Perfect Circle.
Oh, that's cool. All right.
Yeah, what was cool about that is they opened for Nine Inch Nails and Marilyn Manson. So that was a really good show.
Wow, okay, yeah, that's a really good lineup. Wow.
But it was right around the time that Murder in Oms, the first Perfect Circle album, came out.
Mm-hmm.
So most people didn't know really even who Perfect Circle was yet. And I was there with my buddy who could be your older brother. And right. as we're listening to it, I'm like, this band is awesome. Wait, I've heard this song on the radio. This band is awesome. Perfect Circle, right? And that buddy is looking at me and just laughing. I'm like, what, dude? What? He goes, dude, that's Maynard. That's Maynard singing. I'm like, you're fucking kidding me. He's like, no, that's Maynard. This is another band that he's in. That's Maynard singing. Because I already liked Tool at that point. I'm like, oh shit, yeah, that is so awesome.
Yeah.
So
oh,
it was
yeah.
a great night. But anyway, and that was before Marilyn Manson was known for. It was when he was still thought to be a Satanist, but not known to be like really nasty and mean and disrespectful to women, which I'm cool with him being a Satanist, but like treat women right, dude.
Yeah, seriously.
But anyway,
But
Mike, however, Mike takes it's funny. Both, we have such a different approach to our music gathering. I'm looking to get basically album or vinyl representations of my favorite albums that I've had for years. Mm-hmm. Mike, though, it's cool and all, but in many ways, it's kind of just boring. It really is. I mean, it's cool for me because, like, oh my God, I have this version of this now, and that's kind of the collector that I am. You know, I have VHS copies of the Star Wars movie. I have a Betamax of one of the Star Wars movies.
Right.
I'd love to have the laser discs of them, DVDs, Blu-rays. I just get the same shit over and over again in different mediums. Mike goes adventurous on his stuff, and I'm in awe of your kind of adventure that you take when you go to when you're buying these different vinyls, because you get some eclectic and weird shit that's like also really fucking amazing shit, and you're gonna tell us about one of them.
Yes, this time I am. You're correct. Oh, I did want to tell you before I went into the story that I actually was, while I was out and about tonight before we got home and I started doing the recording, I did pick up another record that I just saw on the shelf and could not resist. It is the soundtrack to Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas on double LP. It's a Target exclusive color, transparent purple and green, I think, is what it is.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's four sides, man. It's the whole freaking soundtrack. So I am all over that. I honestly, it's cool. It's got the cool little gatefold thing. I haven't even opened it up yet. Like it's got the inside, the gatefold art and like all this kind of shit. So it's going to be super cool. But yeah, what James is talking about with me is I tend to use the, vinyl format and going and digging through stuff in a record store to kind of find out, you know, I use stuff that I am familiar with and I kind of take trips into the relative unknown based on that. You know, certain songs that I've heard, one hit wonders and stuff like that, I'll just go and, or band members of other bands that I like, I'll just go and find a record for them and see what it's like. I've gotten some discount records with stuff that I had never heard of before, and this story is actually about one of those. So I went to, have we mentioned the name of our favorite, our personal favorite record store? On the
yes, we have. But we can mention it again.
Okay,
we
yeah.
We have mentioned it once, but feel free to mention it again. I mean, whoever is listening in the Sacramento area,
yeah,
go check this place out because it's an awesome little record store.
Yes,
very very neat people in there. It's where I got my my Metallica stage set up, my
yes.
And Justice for All era stage set up, and I got a few albums there, including the Most Adventures. I went, which was to get the Best Little Whorehouse from Texas soundtrack,
yes,
and an original Mary Poppins soundtrack, which is awesome. But that's as far down the adventure line that I went. Stuff that I was at least familiar with.
Oh,
but
yeah.
This is a great place.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The place we're talking about is called The Audio Nerd. They're located out in Rockland. They were a larger record store than they physically are now. What they had to do is over the end of the year, I think the lease went up on a secondary area that they had already owned or they had already been renting. And they called that place their annex, which would have their lower cost records, their more obscure stuff. The CDs and the cassettes would go in that section, and then their main section would basically be all vinyl and hardware. Like, we're talking, like, stereo systems and high-grade speakers and, reel-to-reel tape machines. Like, just nutso, like, eclectic collector-type audiophile shit. So cool. But the good records were kept in the main store. But in the annex, they would have some stuff that was, like, kind of out there, but then they would have their other medium as well there too. Like, they put, dude, they had laser discs out there, they had some video games out there, all that kind of stuff. So when they got to where they were ending their annex area and they were going to kind of like consolidate everything into the small area, the main store, or the bigger of the two places anyway, my wife and I went and rifling through the vinyl and the cassettes to see if we could find anything. Because they had this, like, mad sale at the very end of last year where it was, like,
yeah.
It started out, like, everything was $5 or less. And if it was priced higher than $5, it was $5. And then it went down to, like, $2. And then it went down to $1 in the last week. And then the last few days of that, it was $1 for every single item in that entire area. And if you got 10 items or more, it cut the price in half. So we found that out, and we are rifling through there because we're like 50 cents a piece for a bunch of old cassettes. We found some stuff that that my dad kind of exposed me to a lot, like Loggins and Messina. Like, I know a lot of people probably know, like, Kenny Loggins and stuff from people of our age know Kenny Loggins from, like, the Caddyshack soundtrack. And Highway to the Danger Zone from Top Gun, but the shit that
Footloose, motherfucker,
and Footloose as well. Yeah,
there's Footloose, man.
Calm down there, pal. It's fine. But there was a lot of other stuff that he did with a guy named Jim Messina. Your Mama Don't Dance was probably like the big major hit. But dude, House at Pooh Corner is a fucking fantastic, amazing song. And this was all stuff that he had done in the 70s before he had a huge career surge in the early to mid 80s.
I just want to add real quick, because like, give me a tiny bit of grief, but like, Footloose is one of the best soundtracks of all time.
Footloose was a what's really funny about that is Footloose was like a calling card. So my dad was in a top 40 country band for like 15 years, and right, one of the songs that he would, like, he always wanted to play, like, to edge as close to like rock and roll as he could. So they did, like, the country rock stuff. So they would play Skynyrd, or they would play, Loggins and Messina. But they would do, the little country type stuff or folk music. So they'd play a little bit of Dylan, but they would mostly play, like, I don't know, some Jim Croce, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so So Footloose was their calling card. Like, that was the song everybody loved watching the band play because they were so damn good at it. And they still are. When they get together and they do it, they fucking nail it, man. Every time.
That's a song that does definitely do a whole bunch of genre crossing, because that works. That works even for, it's a little bit more rock for a country, but it still works.
Yeah.
And then the nostalgia of the movie, the fact that where the movie takes place, a country kind of setting, and it all works out to where that song, it's one of those. There's many, many songs that have happened throughout, you know, the last century or so that kind of, there's such a catchy and infectious song that they cross basically borders of almost all. And admittedly, you have a bunch of people that hate them because of how popular they are. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that one song is like, it's just an amazing song. And that whole soundtrack album, that's one of those that, like, there was a time where the soundtrack albums were big deal. There's some out there that it died for a while in the at the end of the 80s going into the 90s. I think one soundtrack album helped to resurrect the concept of the soundtrack album. That, in my opinion, the Crow album for the movie Crow.
Oh, fantastic soundtrack. Absolutely fantastic soundtrack.
But it's one of those things that, like, there are a few of them that between, like, the Crow soundtrack, the soundtrack for Footloose. I won't throw anything that's a musical into there because it's supposed to have music in there. So, like, Grease don't count in here, in what I'm saying.
Right, that makes sense,
but
yeah.
But, like, the Bodyguard soundtrack.
Yep.
Like it or love it, each one of those were just huge, huge, huge soundtracks for movies that, the original Space Jam soundtrack.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever you feel about R. Kelly now, that song was every fucking where.
Oh, yeah.
Everywhere.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, okay. So,
anyway, sorry.
Okay. So, one of the other bands that my dad exposed me to that I got huge into, especially in their early to mid 70s stuff, is a band called Yes. And I don't think you're. Yes.
No.
Yes. I don't know how long we were going to keep that bit up, but that's about as far as it goes, as far as I know.
This reminds me of an episode of The Animaniacs.
Yes.
Slappy yes. the squirrel and her nephew. Niece,
yes.
Whatever,
I absolutely love her. Who's on stage. Yes.
Yes. Who's on stage. Yes.
So Yes is the band. No, Yes isn't even at this show. Who's on stage? That's what I want to know. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I love that sketch. I absolutely love that sketch. It's the best. It's one of that whole episode is fantastic, but that part of it was so good.
I remember watching it, and it was really fun because my sisters were little, and they were laughing watching it.
Yeah.
And I'm laughing watching it because my father and mother were both smart enough to give me culture and have me watch old-time comedic acts and whatnot.
Yeah.
I mean, my father was a huge fan of a bunch of different comedic acts.
Yeah.
Modern ones for his time, like Gallagher. He loved Gallagher.
Oh yes. Oh man, rest in peace to that guy. Wasn't Carlin. He just last year? Rest in peace to Gallagher. I think he just died last year. Like
he
not
did.
Long.
Yeah. But he loved Carlin.
Oh yeah.
He loved a lot of the older comedy acts as well. So I was very well versed in the in Who's On First. Mm-hmm. Very, very well versed in it. So I'm laughing at this, knowing that it's a riff on that.
Yeah.
And I remember distinctly looking over at my dad and he's laughing at it. Normally he just thought most of the cartoons were kind of dumb, but he's laughing at it because he knows it's a riff on that and he thinks it's fantastic.
Oh yeah.
So that was one of those that, like, that reached so many audiences. Because of all the things you can do with the names of rock bands for one.
Oh yeah.
But just that, you know, great humor. But anyway, the band Yes, which, by the way, I will say I probably know songs of theirs, but I don't actually know songs of theirs. Like, I would have no idea that any song is a Yes song. Not my cup of tea.
Yeah, there's
but
like
that,
only,
that one makes sense for you.
Yeah, there's only one from the 80s that I will share with you later that I'm positive that you know. That's the only one, but these guys in the 70s sounded entirely different, and my dad introduced me to them. You know, that's where I get my background on being a fan of, like, Jethro Tull and Led Zeppelin and all. My dad introduced me to all that stuff. Like, that was That's what that was about. Now, that being said, obviously, as the music business does do at times, members of bands tend to move on to do other projects. And some of them end up doing passion projects a lot earlier than you would expect them to. So Yes had a keyboardist named Rick Wakeman. He is no longer with them. I believe he's still alive, but I think he's too old to play. His son, Alan Wakeman, is now the current keyboardist for Yes. And the current incarnation for Yes is fantastic, even though they don't have their original singer, John Anderson. But that being said, and Chris Squire, the founder and the bassist of the band, passed away quite some time ago. He actually passed away, like, I think it was the day after I got married. So it's that's something that touches with me, because where we were at and so much association with all of that is kind of, it kind of sticks with me now. It'll stick with me forever. But the project that I'm talking about,
I do remember that day.
Yeah.
I don't remember the date, but I remember that day. A lot of freaky things happened that day.
A lot of stuff happened that day.
And I missed out on a bunch of freaky things that happened after the wedding. I just know there was me and announcer Scott trying to have fun with another member of the wedding party, keeping that person contained as much as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And then me having to race home from being in Tahoe, where your wedding was at, to take care of home business and not being able to stay for anything that was going on, because crazy stuff was happening at home.
Yeah.
So that was my memory. My day was crazy. I know yours was even crazier, but sorry, continue.
Okay. So, anyway, this gentleman, Rick Wakeman, at 25 years old, he leaves the band Yes for the first time over creative differences. And, he decides, you know what? I think that it's going to be a good idea for me to do something I've had a passion about for a while. And so he wanted to create a concept album that was an homage to King Arthur. Right. And so he starts writing this piece, which, by the way, I think it's just before he starts recording it, he ends up having, what was it? Oh yeah. So he used to smoke and drink a ton. I'm just going to read this first paragraph, because this is going to blow your mind how old he was and what happened to him. Yeah.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Was he American or British?
British.
Okay. This makes more sense. Go on.
Okay. So in July 1974, the 25-year-old Wakeman headlined the Crystal Palace Garden Party 7 concert held at Crystal Palace Park in London with his rock band, a symphony orchestra, and a choir. And that's the thing about prog rock, is the bombasticness and hugeness of everything. And this guy is a prog rock keyboardist. This is like Mozart of a rock band. He knows all of it. He can write every fucking note and tell anyone how to play or do anything, and writes all the parts himself.
I wasn't nearly as educated with you as in classic rock, and especially prog rock.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s. I mean, my father's favorite bands were CCR, the Eagles, and he liked like two Beatles songs,
yeah,
which kind of understands my dislike for the Beatles, other than the fact that I just also dislike them. And then he was a big Elvis fan. Ah. So that was kind of, I got a lot of that.
Okay.
My mother had a little bit more open taste, a little bit of Neil Sedaka thrown in there.
Okay.
Some Paper Lace thrown in there.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, other things like that. But, and then weirdly, she was into Reba McEntire and Conway Twitty. Really weird country selections, cool, but all right.
All right. Yeah.
But I didn't get, they were pretty narrow in their focus of music. They didn't have, and neither one of them really musicians. My mother was in band in high school, but didn't do anything with it afterwards. So neither were musicians. So they didn't really explore more than what they found what they liked, and they liked it, and they, you know, cut it off. But in the 90s, when Metallica did their S&M concert, the very first one, near the end of the 90s, 2000 or whatever it was, people talked about how huge a thing that was, that a rock band, a metal band, was doing a show with a symphony. And at the time, I didn't know any better, because I still was just starting to broaden my horizons in music.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, this is so revolutionary. This is so amazing. And then the more I learned about various things, the more I realized that The only thing that was revolutionary about it was the massive marketing campaign that Metallica did to sell how unusual of an occurrence it was. It's really not that unusual of an occurrence for different types of heavier music and more progressive and modern music to have all of those classical elements built into them. It's
absolutely
just, These were places that didn't necessarily have the same marketing machine that that Metallica did then, and by the way, still employs today. Their marketing machine is amazing. They stay at the cutting edge of that stuff. But yeah, this is not a surprise that even back in the 70s, you had these people doing these things that later would be considered avant-garde. Nope, you're a little late to the party, pal.
Yeah, well, yeah, depending. Yeah, I would agree somewhat with that. But I think you're very right, especially with the idea of classical influence on modern music is way more far reaching than most people give it credit for.
Most definitely.
And that is where this guy comes in, because he wore that on his sleeve. So especially,
and you mentioned Mozart, just so we're clear. Mozart was a badass in his day.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And he was a dirty little badass too.
He was. You know what I actually found out that never actually made it to film? Oh my gosh, who is it that played? So there, did you know Amadeus was a stage play before it was a film?
Yeah, but I'm a theater guy, so yeah.
Did you know who played Mozart in Amadeus? And who played Salieri in Amadeus in that time, 1980?
There's been multiple who played it, but you're talking about the one where Ian McKellen was Salieri, right?
Ian McKellen was Salieri, and Tim Curry was Mozart.
Yeah.
Curry was
fantastic on stage doing that. McKellen. See, most people, again, don't realize, they only think of McKellen from, most American audiences only think of McKellen from basically X-Men and Lord of the Rings on.
Yeah.
But like, he was one of the most respected stage actors in England for like, decades. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Decades of work.
This guy
is absolutely brilliant. Apparently he has a very large penis as well. but large enough that when he was naked on stage, critics had to write about how large his penis was.
Oh my god.
Seriously, no.
King Lear, right?
Because
King Lear?
Yes, go Ian, man. Go Ian.
Good God.
He is a tricksy little queen. I'll say that for sure. This guy's amazing. Ian McKellen, great actor, great personality, funny ass dude, and an amazing performer just all around with everything that he does. And then Tim Curry. What do you expect?
Right, of course. Yeah.
But yeah, in the movie version, of course, is F. Murray Abraham as Salieri and Tom Hulce as Mozart. But still, Mozart was a dirty little dude. He wrote a song called "Lick My Ass." So
yes.
I mean, that's you want to talk about a metal dude? That's a metal dude.
Oh yes,
classical music was metal back in the
absolutely.
Day.
Absolutely. So anyway, moving on to this whole thing, getting to the background of it. So he had played this concert with his band, a symphony orchestra, and a choir. Rick Wakeman had. He left the progressive rock band, 2 months prior over differences surrounding their creative direction, and continued with his solo career, which had reached newfound success after his second album, Journey to the Center of the Earth, had become the first from A&M Records to ever chart at number one. This is a progressive rock keyboardist that had the first number one record for A&M Records Company, which is crazy.
Nice.
Now, despite the success, Wakeman's health deteriorated during the preparations for the Crystal Palace show. The stress of putting it together resulted in Wakeman going without sleep for 5 whole days prior to the event.
You become crazy at that point.
And then he cracked bones in his wrist after he fell over in a pub. So not only was he not sleeping, he was also drinking and smoking frequently and fell over and broke his wrist while he was going insane. What ended up happening before he went on stage, he got 3 injections of painkillers, including one of morphine. So this guy is drunk. He's smoking. He's crazy. He's taking morphine so that he can play the show. And because of that, the situation culminated several days later with Wakeman having 3 minor heart attacks at 25 years old. This guy was ready to kill himself. Like, almost absolutely, which is freaking insane. So, during his recovery, he is at Wexham Park Hospital in Berkshire. Wakeman's management pays him a visit and tells him he needs to stop performing and retire. And he's like, fuck you. I'm not doing that. The guy ends up writing a new album, like starting to write a new album that evening from the hospital bed in secret.
He's like the British version of the more talented British version of Nikki Sixx.
So this guy refuses to quit. He starts writing. He has a friend. Talented. Right. He has a friend sneak in a tape recorder so he can start recording his own parts, like just singing into it and singing his own parts and recording lyrics and that kind of stuff. From in the hospital bed, he had to hide a tape recorder so that he could remember all this shit while he's writing. Now,
that's some dedication. I mean, when my great grandmother was in the hospice care,
yeah,
that she was in, she would hide like ho-hos and ding-dongs and whatnot. I'm talking like the chocolate, you know, pastry things.
Right.
Not something else, people. But she'd hide those and sneak those when she got an opportunity to. I mean, she just wanted to eat sweets. This dude was just
this guy's ready to go to work, man. Yeah. This guy's ready to go to work and fucking work on his passion, regardless of whether or not his hand works or his heart works. Like, he's ready to get some shit done, which is crazy. Like, absolutely crazy. I applaud the drive. I cannot believe, I mean, to the point where he's hurting himself. Yeah, that kind of sucks. But hey, man, he wanted to get it out. So what ends up happening is he then remembers, like, he starts writing the music, right? And then he then remembers on an experience he had as a child, where he'd stayed on a farm in Trafalgar, Cornwall, which is near to the purported legendary site of Arthur's Castle in Tintagel. And he stayed there for like 5 months. And so here he is as a child soaking up the lore and just absolutely loving every bit of it, right? So he's
also trying not to be bored as fuck in Cornwall.
Yeah, right? As a child. And so what's he doing? He's learning about like he's learning about the legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and all this kind of stuff. So it sticks with him for his whole life, and he decides in the hospital bed to make a concept album based on the legend of King Arthur. And so he reveals the album in the music press. Now, this is, remember, he made the decision to do this in a hospital bed when he had 3 heart attacks in July. It gets announced officially in August of the same year that he's working on it. So now it's announced. Now, this is one of the things, one of the patterns he likes to do. He likes to announce shit, and therefore that commits the record company to doing something and letting him do something he wants. Rather than saying, I would like to do this, and the record company's like, no, we don't think that that's good. No, he talks to somebody in public and says, I'm recording an album based on King Arthur. And the record company was like, fuck, now we have to do it because he's announced it in public. And he keeps doing this to them, by the way, over and over. So anyway, he commits and finishes a North American tour in 1974. And then he books studio time and writes the album in October of 1974. Does the album, records it, does the whole deal, okay? Now, after the recording, the part that I really want to talk about, and this album, by the way, is absolutely fantastic. The one, the copy that I got, that I picked up, it's only one disc. It sounds like it should be two. It seems like it should be when you listen to it, but it's got some bangers in there as far as like classical progressive rock. But the more impressive part of it is the fact that I didn't realize I picked up like a full package. So I got the record in the sleeve, but inside of it, there's also a lyric book that's like got multiple pages. I thought it was a poster in one side of it. It's a full lyric book that's got like the lyrics for all the songs and the song credits, but everything's written in like that old style English script. And it has full pictures. It's a full book that is like supposed to accompany the album [S2] Nice. [S1] While you're listening to it. And it's, and you know, so it's like
the, flipping. It's got the different pictures in the, in within the words, and then along the borders. And
yeah,
by the way, there for people who are bigger, you know, way bigger history buffs than me, there are specific names for that, for those type of pictures and where they're located. I just don't know the names.
I don't either. Yeah,
I'm not going to flash. Sorry, I can't flash that much intelligence and knowledge. But I do know that they have specific names for them. That's cool shit.
Yeah. Now, that being said, is the song, which I think is the second song on the album, Arthur. It's just called Arthur. Arthur has been used by the BBC as the theme song to its election night coverage, starting in 1979, all the way up to 1997 and 2005, and they used it again for the UK general election coverage in 2019. So this is something that just keeps seeing money, right? And it's, I think it's fucking great. But this is the meat of why I wanted to tell this story, because of how ridiculous this is. Now, from what I'm going to do at this point, and I'm going to read directly from the Wikipedia page on this album. The name of the album, to anybody who's interested at this point, is literally called The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. So, to promote the show, Wakeman wanted a unique show for King Arthur in England, his first UK shows since Crystal Palace, rather than a standard concert performance. An early idea of his was to perform the album at Tintagel Castle as part of a King Arthur Day event with a medieval pageant and jousting knights. Wakeman was informed the castle was unsuitable for concerts, so he suggested to his promoter the idea of staging the show in a field beside it with a large inflatable castle. After traveling to Tintagel to investigate the possibility, his promoter's name is Harvey Goldsmith. Goldsmith found the land was crown property, duh, and a series of letters to the Duchy of Cornwall about the show failed to generate a response, so they couldn't get permission to play at Tintagel. A show at Tintagel was abandoned. Oh, what's up?
By the way, I just want to say, I believe that that would be the Duke of Cornwall, right? Duke of Cornwall would have been, actually, I don't know. Okay, go on. Sorry, I thought I knew who the Duke of Cornwall would have been at that time, but I don't. Go on.
Is it, so is it pronounced Duke? I thought Duke was pronounced D-U-K-E. This no, is that, pronounced D-U-C-H-Y. Yeah,
that is the,
spelled,
the
excuse
Duchy
me.
Would be, the, it is the Duchy of Cornwall, and that's the... That's the kind of household of the Duke, or if there's a Duchess, there's that too, but that's the household. The
Duchy, I see.
The
yeah.
Household of it.
Yeah. The eldest son of the reigning.
The Duke
okay.
Specifically.
Yeah, I see that. The eldest son of the reigning British monarch obtains possession of the Duchy and the title of Duke of Cornwall at birth.
So it was Charles. It was Charles. Okay.
I believe it was Charles at the time. Yeah. So anyway, yeah, cause this is in the '70s. You're right. It is Charles.
That's what I thought it was, but I wasn't positive.
Yes. So, a show at Tintagel was abandoned, and Wakeman suggested Wembley Stadium, but Goldsmith explained that it was not feasible, probably because Wembley Stadium was too large. So he went, okay, well, how about Wembley Arena? But, and here's where it got real interesting, booking the venue caused a problem, as the Ice Follies were scheduled to perform afterwards, and the arena had already become an ice rink. Goldsmith and Wakeman's management instead suggested a scaled-down show at the Royal Albert Hall, but Wakeman insisted on Wembley and subsequently told a Melody Maker reporter that he would be presenting King Arthur as an ice show. So he just announced, oh, yeah, King Arthur is an ice show now, because his management wanted to book a smaller venue, and he said, fuck that. So he tells the news, it's an ice show, so there's no going back now. So now they had to design a fucking ice show because he wanted to. Set it in public and it was done. King Arthur was performed for 3 sellout nights from the 30th to 31st of May and the 1st of June that were attended by 27,000 people in total. Wakeman funded the production with his own money, which included his band, the English Rock Ensemble, an orchestra and choir playing in the round, a narrator, and 19 international ice skaters who reenacted the scenes in costume. A sound system by Clare Brothers had to be shipped in from the United States, as there was not a system in England suitable for the event. Though the shows sold out and raised publicity for the album, they ultimately ended up losing money because they were so fucking expensive. The original plan was to hold 3 evening shows with a matinee on the 31st of May, which would have helped bring the production to a small profit, but that was canceled. One show was filmed and broadcast on television. Production.
I need to find that.
I know, right? I want to see this shit too. Production problems.
Yes.
Yeah. Production problems became manifest early on. When it was announced that horses would be part of the show, animal welfare groups demanded it be canceled. Wakeman responded with a press conference at the venue where skaters dressed as knights came out riding two-dimensional wooden horses, saying, "You weren't thinking they were going to be real horses, were you?" The first performance.
Hold on. Was this guy friends with members of Monty Python?
I think actually he might have been.
Okay. That would totally make sense.
I think there was, there may be some ties in, because Monty Python has ties in with members of, oh my God, George Harrison was in on all that shit. I think some of the guys from Led Zeppelin were in there. The guys from Yes totally like are from the same area. They'd totally be part of that shit. I think it'd be great. All right. So the first performance was, in the words of Wikipedia, imperfect. When the actor, these are some of the bloopers that happened during the actual first performance. When the actor playing the young Arthur pulled the sword from the stone, the anvil used to anchor the sword came out as well, since it had not itself been anchored. So Arthur pulls the sword and the anchor comes out with it. The actress playing Guinevere inadvertently skated over her own veil, tearing her headgear out. The chainmail under Wakeman's cape, so Wakeman, the keyboardist, under his cape accidentally caught on something as he was descending from his seat at one point, leaving him dangling over the ice. And this is one of my favorite parts. The dry ice fog, when used over real ice, created a mist that rose ever higher and thicker, to the point that the musicians not only couldn't see each other, but had difficulty seeing their own instruments clearly enough. So it's just like you could barely see anything going on. At the end, during the last battle, plans called for 6 skaters dressed as knights to take to the ice and fight to their mutual deaths. Well before the song was over, one knight appeared to have survived to skate aimlessly around the ice. Wakeman saw him and realized that one of the skaters had called in sick that day and the production had failed to find a replacement. The skater solved the problem by pretending to throw himself on his own sword and disappearing under the fog.
Well, yeah, you gotta improvise sometimes.
Yeah, I think that was great. He just fell on his own sword. What else can you do? The production was ranked number 79 on the list of 100 greatest shocking moments in rock and roll compiled by VH1. And apparently Wakeman has stated that he wants to try to do King Arthur on Ice once again. He said it back in 2014. I highly doubt that it's going to be done. But he did re-record the entire album as a two-disc, as a full two-disc opus. So he like doubled the amount of music from the original record. Because it was actually, no, it was more than that. Let's see, the track listing is only 7 songs for one disc, and then the track listing for the 2016 re-recording of the whole thing is 20 tracks. But this, like, I will say this, as far as the version of the album that I have, I absolutely love it. I thought it was a trip to just sit and read on it while I was, you know, listening to it. It was absolutely its own experience. I absolutely give anybody who has the time or who wants to check this out to check this album out. It's absolutely probably not like anything else you've ever heard before, but it is really cool. It's got that medieval vibe to it, but it's extremely eclectic. It's very virtuosic. It's a trip. It's a total trip of a musical endeavor. But I will say that just the accompanying art in and of itself is so cool, man. It really is.
Well, I mean, for one, that's one of the fun things about the record collecting, is the fact that with the size of the media, with it being as big as it is, 12-inch roughly,
yeah,
for everything, you can do so much more with the art, so much more with the packaging. Again, newer bands are doing that, but back in the heyday of music, there were still many bands, especially with some of the rock bands. Prog rock would be a good example of bands that did this, that would do all kinds of weird and wacky things with their albums and have things like posters in them,
mm-hmm.
and just all kinds of extra things that are, that were just a little bit more to have it. And that's, as you know, as part of this, again, this journey you and I are both going on with record collecting, admittedly, you've done a lot more like this one. That's interesting and, you know, off the beaten path type of stuff. And it does inspire me to want to go that extra bit and not just get, well, I mean, once I'm done getting all the ones that I feel I need to have, then make it an experience of finding all these little gems, all these little hidden things that could be something neat, could be something special, or maybe it's just something that's a nice, you know, talking piece.
Yeah.
At some point or another.
Yeah, absolutely. But I kind of look into that kind of stuff. I've been, just as an engineer, I start looking for other weird controversial shit. I'm actually doing, right now I finished the script and I will be doing the vocal recording for for it, so I can get into the editing stage, for a video on what I like to call the forbidden Jimi Hendrix albums. There's a bunch of albums that were done, that Jimmy recorded a bunch of material just before he died. He died in 1970. Hey,
I thought you were maybe talking about the posthumous stuff. Okay.
Essentially that's what it is. Yeah. It's the posthumous stuff. But the thing is, there were like one or two official records that came out in like the early 70s. And then there was this break of a couple of years. And then all of a sudden, like 1975, a record comes out and it's got like female backup vocalists and replaced drums and extra dubbed guitars and shit. And, what ended up happening was they got an entirely different guy who never worked with Jimmy to rifle through the old material to see if he could like make albums to try to like make money back. And this wasn't a record label thing. And that's what I'm going to go on. I don't want to give too much of it away, but there is like three or four, what I call forbidden Hendrix albums that were strict. They were basically struck from the Hendrix canon, because they're so misrepresentative of his material. And I do like a little, I'll be doing like a, you know, kind of like sort of like a quasi review on the ones that I found and picked up. And the reason why I could find them is because they're cheap as fuck, because they don't have any worth. Like, they're collector pieces for people that want to hear the music as it was never intended to be heard.
And it was just, again, for anybody listening to this, where you will find this, this extra story is at one of Mike's other YouTube pages.
Thank you.
Ruling Note Music.
Yes. Yeah. That's where it's going to be. That's where it's going to be there. But yeah, I like looking up that kind of stuff. Another one I looked up recently is a guy named Alan Parsons. You've heard of the Alan Parsons Project, right?
Yeah, that was one of Dr. Evil's plans.
Yes. The Alan Parsons Powers movies. Yes. The Alan Parsons Project was a progressive rock group that was active up until like 1990. But it started in the mid 70s, and Alan Parsons he's still alive, but he was, when he was active, he was a producer that worked with everyone from the Beatles through Pink Floyd and just tons of people. But he is probably most famous for being the guy who was on the faders and producing Dark Side of the Moon when it was being recorded. But there is if you get past the, someone who, if you are not a fan of Pink Floyd and you can get past the fact that the album most likely will just put you to sleep, and I don't blame anyone who actually thinks that, I completely understand. I myself am a fan of Floyd, but if you would ever listen to that album, it's one of the best sounding, cleanest sounding records ever made. And this guy's production value, the way that he produces stuff, was fucking legendary. And so I picked up like one or two other albums, and he did one based on like the iRobot story, and not like the Will Smith iRobot. I mean, like the original iRobot from, when is it, like the 1920s or something like that?
Yeah, Isaac Asimov.
Asimov, yes. He did a concept album homage to Asimov. And so there's, nice. That's the kind of shit that's like art, man. That's the stuff that it, like the stuff that succeeds commercially isn't necessarily commercialism and can be considered art if the point of the record is to represent a mindset at that time. If you're trying to create pop music for the purpose of creating pop music, you're just participating in commercialism. You might as well be making AI art But at
we're looking at you, Nickelback.
I mean, to be completely honest, yeah. Like, I don't know how much of their stuff is essentially meant to be written. Well, I'm sure the guys do it for them a little bit, but most of it is because they're doing it to make money.
Well, no, they figured out the algorithm of the song that would get them that would get regular radio airplay and get people to listen to it,
yeah,
and make money. What's funny is one of the times my wife and I fell into a standard YouTube hole of watching list shows.
Oh yeah, you know, like, I love those.
Not specifically the Watch Mojo shows, but shows similar to that.
Yeah,
and we found this one guy who was listing off different albums and different bands that, like, the or even songs, the worst song by the worst band that you know ever thought, or the worst song by the best bands, that kind of thing.
Oh yeah, uh-huh.
On all of the worst lists, every single one of the worst lists was at least one entry with Nickelback. And at least one entry with Five Finger Death Punch, which makes me really happy because I hate both of those bands with a passion. And those are two bands that my wife does like, but she has learned to shut those bands off if I enter the room or get in the vehicle her, because I will ceaselessly mock those songs the entire time that I'm listening. I will not. Most of the music, we have our own different music things. There's a lot of crossover, but there are a lot of differences. I've got no problem with the majority of different things that she listens to, but those two and throw Creed up in there as well. If she's playing any of that stuff, I am mocking the crap out of it over and over again. However, I can say that Nickelback's first album that they released, the first two singles off of that, one of them was called Breathe, the other one was Leader of Men.
Those two songs
were actually decent songs. They were pretty good songs.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Leader of Men, and I actually really like Leader of Men. That's one of the few that I can get behind. That's a decent song.
Look up the song Breathe by them, even though it'll mess up all your search stuff, because then Nickelback will be on all your search from that point.
It's okay, I'll just do it in incognito mode or something.
That works. but Breathe is actually a pretty damn good song. It's a good post grunge style song almost.
Cool. Okay.
But those are the first two songs I heard by them from their first album. I thought, okay, these are two pretty good songs. And then the next album came out, and This Is How You Remind Me of How Shitty a Band You Are. And that's basically what it was from that point on. Every single one of their songs sounded exactly like that. I will add that one of my other favorite bands did an album that basically half the songs on that album were in that same, they followed the Nickelback algorithm of songs, and you could literally play one of their songs, the lead single off of that album, you could play that song with like every Nickelback song that's part of that formula. The way that the length of the verse, the length of the chorus, all everything, they would just match up and play with each other.
Shut up. Seriously. Which song is that? I gotta hear that.
Devil's Bleeding Crown by Volbeat.
Really? I've never heard that song.
It sounds like a Nickelback song. If you really pay attention to it, it has the exact same meter and feel of a Nickelback song. It is a pre-designed radio airplay song.
Okay.
That's not always a bad thing, and especially if the song is a good song, it can be that pre-designed radio airplay song. They just have to be good songs. They have to have good lyrics. They have to have good writers, specifically ones that are not Canadian. but anyway, point being
fair
here,
assessment.
you're right. There can still be, even if you're making something that is made for consumption and, you know, to entertain the populace, it can still be art. And yet at the same time, just because people aren't entertained by it and don't like it doesn't mean that it isn't art as well.
Yeah.
If it is a banana that has been stapled to a wall, that is not really art. That's just not getting rid of your food trash properly.
I don't know. That shit was pretty good, man. I honestly think that, you know what, I think I was having a discussion about art versus commercialism with Tash not too long ago. I want to say it was last week. And one of the things that really got us, because we've gone back and forth over the whole AI thing, because there's a lot of people that are losing their shit right now about like AI art and whether or not it's taking away from the what?
What does the A stand for?
Exactly. So no, let me.
You broke the joke. Go on.
Well, I didn't break the joke. If you don't know what it stands for at this point, you should just Google it.
Oh.
Because it'll tell you.
And what does the I stand for?
Exactly.
For anybody that doesn't know, that was a red versus blue cut, but going on.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't know that. I had no idea.
Yeah, that was a private donut. So
I don't know what the fuck that means, but okay. So anyway,
it was a caboose. I don't know. Anyway,
I don't know. But there's been like the general argument that I've heard about AI art posing a danger to actual artists. As far as the potential for how lucrative art is for struggling artists that are trying to make a living, which to a degree I kind of understand, but the problem is that if you're being commissioned to do an art piece that's meant to fit so that it's meant to be commercialized specifically, like most artists died destitute. Like most artists died poor. Their art wasn't worth anything, and it wasn't done for a fee most of the time. Like you had like Michelangelo was hired to paint the Sistine Chapel. I don't know how much he was hired for, but I will tell you that is a flat out blatant example of what commercialism is. That was the point. The point was to make a church look pretty. They asked an artist to make a church look pretty. At that point, that is commercialism at work. You're doing that to sell the church to people. That's the point. Now, as far as that's concerned, if you're talking about being hit up and commissioned because of your style, I have not seen, nor do I honestly heavily doubt at this point, that there is going to be anything that's really going to hold a candle to actual art. I've seen interesting takes on stuff, but I mean, all you have to do is look at an AI image for longer than half of a second to find out how uncanny valley it is, no matter what the style is. Looks like it's scary. It looks like it's scary because it looks kind of close. And this is farther than it's ever been, but it's still got so fucking far to go before it looks anything to that degree. And at that point, like, you're still going to have artists get hired. But you also have to think of the way that art works as well. A really good example is, did you ever see the Banksy piece that was done? There's a couple of examples I have.
What, the shredded one?
Yes. It was sold, okay, and then it was shredded. That's the art part.
Yeah, I know, and I right? understand that. I actually respect that one. One of the things to understand, though, first of all, is that the modern high art world, the like paying for artworks and moving it around and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Let's have the understanding that that is, first of all, a gigantic tax and money laundering scheme.
You're talking about, yeah, because it's commercializing actual art is what it's doing.
No, it's literally legalized money laundering. That is what it's. That's what the whole art selling scene is designed for, is ways to move money around and to evade taxes and all of that stuff.
Oh.
So whatever value is ascribed to any professional pieces of artwork. Oh yes, this is a painting by, you know, some French or, you know, Italian or, yeah, you know, Scandinavian named dude. This is some awesome painting by that person, and it's now going for $5 million. And why? Because the original owner of it wants to have a $5 million tax deduction. That is that. First of all, that's the art world. That's what it's at. I mean, that's what its purpose is. the thing about art is, again, it's so such a subjective thing. I mean, how many times have we just on here, and we talk movies a lot because movies were very influential for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have we talked about a movie that, you know, one group thinks is one of the best artistic representations of a comic book character ever, and another group says that's not even a fucking comic book character. Why do you keep saying that? That's a blight on the comic book world. You have major film directors who are looking at an entire movie universe and saying that's not really artistic, that's not really cinema is art. And yet you have a large group of people that are inspired by what is a very beautifully shot, well-rendered story arcing over, you know, multiple movies requiring multiple people to be involved and eliciting emotional response. What's the purpose of art other than to elicit some type of emotional response? The subjective nature of it is the biggest thing about it. We're, you know, you're talking about this guy, Wakeman, who was, you know, prog rock guy, did some, looks like amazing number of albums on his own. I think I looked, there was at least 10 albums on his own that he did.
Oh yeah.
And these massive productions. And, you know, you have entire, he's one member of this entire genre of music that if you like any of that genre, suddenly you're pegged into being a fan. Oh, you're a prog rock guy. You're into, you know, specifically prog rock music. I know there's 4 or 5 prog rock bands that I know that you're a fan of. Does that mean that that's the only thing that you can see the beauty in? Or conversely, is only somebody like you able to see the beauty in progressive rock? The consumption of any form of art is so subjective, and it does get a little scary when you're dealing with the monetizing of it, and specifically stuff that is created just for the purpose of monetizing without a marked lack of real artistic ingenuity and uniqueness, and mm-hmm. more just cookie cutter, put it out there and make money on it. And that is definitely where the I don't know, the lines start to get drawn in the debate. Are these things still art, even if they're created without any kind of emotion and soul, and without eliciting any emotion and soul? Is that still art?
Exactly.
It's a good debate on it. The thing is, all it takes is one person to view it as art for it to be art. That's all it takes, is one person. You think it would be, you would have to be more, but no, if somebody sees that as being art, if somebody has emotions elicited from it, even let's be realistic about this. Now I can admit this, as much as I hate those bands that we've talked about over and over again, the fact that it is eliciting the emotion of hate, does that make it art? Could it make it art?
It very well could, because it is eliciting still an emotion. As far as the emotion of to be completely honest, with some of the AIR I've seen, it can evoke, if it can be considered art, which is the argument here, if all the art is to do is to elicit some type of an emotion to a degree, I would state that this does elicit an emotion, and that emotion is it's a
violation?
It's discomfort.
An abomination?
No. Well, no, not an abomination, but it does, as if you were to look at a piece of AI art and you take a look at it for a second, you get drawn into it by its accuracy to a degree, and then you notice the inaccuracies that sit within it. And so it hits the same level of discomfort that any uncanny valley feeling can give you. And that's the point to me. I'm looking at all this and going, this doesn't, you look at something and say there's a void between what you initially see and what you actually see when you look at it. So that void, to me, evokes the emotion of discomfort. And so, technically speaking, that can still be considered art. It is just an art that is supposed to make you, maybe it, what's the point of it could be that it is to evoke discomfort, like it's supposed to be uncomfortable. Is it, or is it that it is making an attempt to evoke a different emotion and hits discomfort on accident.
Okay, because I'm a Luddite and I don't understand this, is this, when you're talking about AI art, is this just like literally some artificial intelligence just randomly thinks the shit up? Or is there some, is there an involvement with a human person manipulating some kind of an app or some kind of a thing.
Okay, so here's how AI art works. If you have, you seen any AI art, because that's kind of like the newer trend that's starting to kick in. The way the AI art works is you can go to a website, you can go onto an app that are, it's basically server based. Okay, and so essentially what happens is you type in something that you want to see, and an algorithm compiles the image based on other examples that it pulls from based on what you and other people have asked it to do. So if I were to say, The Nightmare Before Christmas, and I'm just looking around the room here, in the style of Jim Henson, okay? And then it auto-generates an image, like this is an algorithm generating an image of Jack Skellington looking like a hand Muppet, okay?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you something right now, because since you started this conversation, I looked up and was looking at different pictures of AI-generated art.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to give you a controversial opinion on this.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually really interested in looking into this myself.
Well, there's a level of intrigue to it for sure.
Specifically because for people like me who can't, I'm in awe of people who can create art. I'm in awe of my son who makes sculptures out of, pipe cleaner.
Yeah.
Okay. And he makes kaiju, you know, giant monsters, Godzilla, Ghidorah, Mothra, Rodan, not the artist, but like the pterodactyl, you know, creature.
Mm-hmm.
He makes these things out of pipe cleaners, full 3D, all of the spikes that are necessary. In fact, you can even differentiate between the multiple Godzillas that he has, which era of Godzilla he has made by the shape of its face and the shape of the spines on the back. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's with a medium like pipe cleaner. I'm terrified to see what he can do when you give him something more of a medium to work with. At some point, he's going to graduate into clay and start sculpting maquettes and shit for you know, Lucasfilm or whatnot.
Yeah,
which would be fantastic. Then he could get me an in. I may be super old at that point, but that's all right. I'll play aging whoever. Doesn't matter. But the ability to get that information out, I can see these wonderful things in my head. I mean, I've come up with ideas for films that I'd like to write, and I can come up with dialogue, and I figure, you know, that I could possibly maybe film the stuff, but to create the backgrounds that I'm looking for, to create the worlds that I'm looking for, I can't get the stuff out of my head and onto paper or onto the computer or any of those things. So in the past, whenever I've had designs and stuff, things like that I've wanted created, thematic things, I've had to turn to people that I know are artists,
mm-hmm.
to tell them what I'm looking for and have them render it for me, have them draw mm-hmm. it out. This gives me the ability to have an AI do it and tweak it and probably do it a hell of a lot faster than it takes for a human to do it, and not have to worry. There will be algorithm bias in this, but there won't be the specific human bias that I'm dealing with the person. If I tell one of these AI generators that they got it wrong, they're not going to be pissed at me and say, well, I do my art the way I want to do my art. If you don't like it, don't ask me to do it. So for somebody like me who wants to see some of the things in my brain come out and be able to show it to other people, but I have no means to do that, This could actually be a completely life altering thing. I can see so many visuals that I would love to be able to put forward. The things that I see when I read books, I know that you and I have had many discussions about reading in the past, and I don't know what your process is when you're reading a novel and how you think about the action that you're reading and the characters that you're reading about, but there's a fucking movie playing in my head the entire time. A fully realized movie. I mean, I am the camera moving through this movie, watching mm-hmm. everything happen. Fully realized, I see the sky, the grass, the trees, the buckle of the belt on a person. I see every, if it's described to me in text, I see it. And if it's not, I create it. And to be able to get that stuff out through something like this, you were the first time you sent me a message, I think a week or two ago, maybe mm-hmm. a week ago, about, you commented on listener Alex's, a post. You commented on it being looking like AI art. That was the first that I had really seen anything about it. My finger is,
oh, wow.
In this thing, my finger is very far away from the pulse.
Oh, wow. Okay. Okay. You know what's really funny that you have mentioned as far as everything that you just said? Okay. There's a couple of things I want to mention to you that I want to bring to light for you, because this is you're kind of getting a crash course in how this shit works. And your initial reaction, what you just said about not having to worry about other human beings and being able to get an image a little bit easier than where being able to get an image a little bit easier than having to deal with somebody else to render that image for you based upon their experience and their viewpoint as well. Those two points that you just made are two of the major points that are argued against as a fear of it, because that removes the opportunity for someone to be able to do that versus punching it into a machine. But another thing that it's doing is this algorithm is also, and it has, I don't know if it's been inherently fully proven, and I'm saying this to play devil's advocate here, okay? Like, just to say it. I have my own different opinion. I have my own opinions about how this operates, and I personally don't consider this to be particularly really dangerous. I don't. I don't consider it to be a major threat, because there are other steps on top of what you're talking about. But the initial idea of being able to do what you're talking about, it makes sense to be enamored with that possibility, okay? Because that's where the whole appeal kicked in right out the gate, okay? But the way that they're doing this is they are apparently, what is happening is they are stealing and compiling imagery taken by other people in order to form something else, which, technically speaking, legally, that's transformative. So to be real, that's actually already been proven to be legal. Being transformative, you could take a piece of art and move it to another medium. Considered transformative. But
what are memes but basically transformative art?
Yeah, that's exactly what they are. And to be completely honest, what you're doing right now, what you're talking about, what you're asking for is the same thing people look for on Google all the time. They're asking a machine to do the research for them. This is the same idea, except it's using pictures instead of words. It's using words and it's using examples from other people, from all of the history and information that exists on the internet, to compile an image based on what this algorithm is capable of doing. Will it do what a human can? No, it can't. It won't. But what it will allow is for someone like you to be able to take a look and maybe get a bit more of a visual representation of what is in your head, so you don't have to worry about doing it. And I honestly consider that to be a benefit for those that are looking for something like this. As far as the fear that some people have over whether or not this is going to take that capability away from them, I am not convinced. I'm personally not convinced, and I think that's a confidence issue. I really do. But if you want to do that, then you need to shift your business medium or whatever the hell terminology you should be using in order to accommodate to that, because there are ways of solving those problems that don't include having to rally against a computer. in order to achieve those things. You can work past something like this. And honestly, it's not exactly an obstacle. I personally don't believe that it is. Yeah, people have been using AI to generate music for the last fucking 25 years.
What about something like auto-tune, which basically makes people who can't sing sound like they can't sing a little bit better than they did?
And that's one of the things you could argue. I think it's a little bit removed because it still requires a human performance, but hiring a person still
requires at least input from the human.
Yeah. Yes, you're right. It does, because you got to be able to type it and say, I'm giving it this idea. Here's the crazy part, though. And here's the part where a lot of people are not understanding. This is actually a very important point. And I want to put this out before, if I may, I really want to put this out there. The thing about AI art is that because it is compiled from multiple sources, AI art has been ruled out to be public domain, no matter what the image is. Even if somebody gives it an idea, being that you did not create the image yourself and a computer did it for you, that image is public domain. You do not own it. Just because you made a request for it to tell it to do something for you does not mean that you own the image. Nobody does. It is public domain. That means anybody could take that image and use it in whatever capacity that they wish, because it's fucking free.
Okay.
And that's fine.
I see that as being an appropriate trade-off.
Absolutely. I consider that too. I consider that possibility too. Now what are people doing is they're using AI art to generate the weirdest fucking memes from the darkest corners of the meme universe that could possibly be created. I have seen drinking parties in the catacombs. I have seen The Legend of Zelda in the style of Miyazaki. I have seen there was one that I did that just looks fucking weird. It looks like I did one because I wanted to do a public domain image for a friend of mine whose album art was a guy who is playing an oboe and he's covered in bees. It's like an old image. It's been around. The guy has long since passed away, but somebody owns that picture. They own the copyright to that picture. And this guy used that picture for his album cover. Well, you can't just go ahead and use it again, because you could get sued by whoever owns it. So I went to an AI image generator and I typed man playing clarinet covered in bees. And the shit that came out looks like it looks like Adam Jones fucking made concept art for the movie Candyman. It's fucking nuts looking. It's cool. It's absolutely not representative of, like, me myself, what I thought that it would be. But it is cool imagery, and it's really weird, and it's discomforting.
Could you clarify for listeners who you're referring to with Adam Jones?
Yeah, Adam Jones is the guitarist, and I knew you'd get a kick out of that. Adam Jones, to anybody who doesn't know, Adam Jones is the guitarist and basically main artist for every one of Tool's records. Like, it's his art that you're seeing every time.
And whatever music videos that they ever had, he did all the art for and the direction for all those videos.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it is that AI art shit is super fun, but here's the thing. It's kind of like, it's very communal. Everybody owns it. Everybody has access to it. Like, you don't have to, like, if you know where to go and you know which bot to look for, you don't have to pay for it. Nobody does. It means you don't own it, but you do some weird shit. And that's honestly, like, it's meme worthy shit at this point. Can you do high resolution? Yeah. But I've seen people stealing other people's art by literally taking a photo of an Instagram page, screenshotting. There was a guy who won in court like 4 or 5 years ago. He screenshotted Instagram posts, removed the names, just put the captions underneath it, and then a couple of comment captions, put them on printed them out on canvas, and then sold them for thousands of dollars and won in court because it was considered transformative, even though it was a photo that somebody took of themselves with their own phone and then posted it to Instagram. This guy's making money on just transferring it and then doing a small bit of editing from a screenshot.
I mean, I look at this in a similar vein as when it comes to, like, music stuff. people who use like MIDI stuff and you know, captured sounds that they throw in to different things, and it's the same type of thing. You're you know, is that person a musician using those things? But that's
possibly
again,
not.
That's...
But does it? Are they a? Here's the funny part: they may possibly not be a musician, but at that point, it may or may not make them a composer. Are they playing somebody else's music, or are they composing their own using an instrument that nobody else thought of using? They recorded, I don't know, somebody. They recorded, you know, somebody knocking an empty metal canister against a table and got a weird ping out of it, and then decided to map that to a keyboard. And how did they do that? They used a fucking computer to do it.
Yep.
And that shit's been done for decades now. So people getting pissed at this just because it's visual art, it doesn't change anything. Art will still be art, and people can still make art, and they can make damn good art, and that art will evolve, and it will take other forms. But you're still going to have involvement with humans in order to do that. People that use computers or iPads to draw something, even though it's their hand that's drawing it and they're using a computer to do it, there's still that personal effect. The medium is nothing. And
I can actually say that I know a few people who are artistically inclined insofar as painting, drawing, that kind of art inclined. Mm-hmm. And it's very similar to the divide that I know kind of that there was a divide that existed at one point between tabletop role-playing gamers and LARPers, and then online role-playing games, card-based role-playing games. Each one was its own like separate tier. I had many friends who started in the tabletop and progressed onto all the other things. Speaking of which, one of my children came to me the other day, and the oldest one, in fact, was asking about the most recent World of Warcraft game that was being released.
Wow.
It's got a gigantic dragon that's on fire in it, which is, you know, huge monster, fire, totally his bag. And
right.
He was like, hey, let's get into it. I got you on the WoW thing. I just kept going.
You're good.
He was like, hey, can we get this game, Dad? Can we get this game? Like, one, that's played on computers, and we don't have computers that can play that. We don't have computers good enough to play that. Oh, okay. Two, each person's going to need their own computer to play, because he likes to play games co-op. He doesn't like to play games by himself, and definitely not online by himself. He goes, we need our own computers, each person on a different computer, for us to try to play together in any way, shape, or form. And he's like, oh, okay. Said, also, your mom said that if I ever played that game, she would leave. And then he went into a panic. And I had to talk him down on that.
Oh, no.
But you know, I've seen the people that are the artists that there's a lot of shade thrown at people who are artists that use tablets and computers and whatnot in comparison to artists that use the real natural methods of art. You know, canvas.
Natural methods of
yeah.
Yeah. It's like the same idea of what was it? I think there was one of my favorite memes I'd ever seen is Jimmy Page holding a guitar up in the air, and it says, you know, way back in the day before computers and autotune, people used to make livings by stealing music from black people. And I always thought that was really funny, but it doesn't matter about the medium. It matters about, like, it says what I was saying earlier before you had said something.
Well, no, because even with all the new computers and stuff, people are still making money by stealing music from black people.
Yeah, right. So that said, what I wanted to make sure was known, when I said the medium means nothing, I mean that it doesn't. I mean that doesn't mean anything, especially in comparison to the emotion that the art then elicits. It's the emotional response the art elicits that makes it important. And I honestly, it would take a very long time from now, if at all. I honestly think it would very long time, if at all, without some type of major human interacting, essentially acting as the hand of God to put that to put the humanness into something that is created by a computer. I mean, you got CGI-based special effects and shit all the time that get called out because they age terribly most of the time.
Well, I mean...
Obviously, it depends on the film and all that kind of stuff, but eventually that stuff ages and it hits a level of uncanny valley. But in order to achieve that level of reality, or at least perceive reality, when you're watching a movie made out of CGI or a scene from a film that uses CGI, you have to have somebody guiding the hand of the algorithm in order to generate something that elicits that response to hit a hint of realism. AI art is going to be way too far from that right now.
Is this why in almost every post-apocalyptic movie and story where it's robots or artificial intelligence that takes us out, they do this because they make shitty art. That's what it is.
Yeah, that's what started the Matrix, guys. It was all a jealousy ploy. They were pissed off because we kept Isn't that part of what happened? Was in the story of the Matrix, they created the ultimate utopia, and people refuted it.
They create multiple versions of the Matrix, and humanity continues to reject it because they can't make the machines can't make something that is truly close enough to lifelike for the human brain to comprehend. There's always something wrong with it.
Right. That's the idea of the uncanny valley. That's where it always hits.
That's the Wachowskis thinking even further ahead than we give them credit for.
Oh yeah.
Them two ladies had their heads on their shoulders. Seriously, that's so many different levels to those movies, even though again the CGI aged kind of bad. But anyway.
Yeah, there was, I guess, I don't know, maybe it's art imitating life at that point.
Maybe. Maybe the entire purpose was for the CGI to age bad. That was that iteration of the Matrix. I mean, it wasn't as good. There were still some bugs to work out.
Exactly. That was the early version. Shit. That actually makes sense in the continuity. That makes sense in the Matrix continuity, the capability of the CGI not looking as good 20 years ago to come back and then look better in the 60-year forward. That's great.
Hell yes. It's a lot better, a whole lot better than going back to the prequels in freaking Star Wars. Like, holy crap, this all looks so much better now. Well, yeah, because we're at the height of the Old Republic, so everything looks cleaner and better and not as terrible.
Right.
Like, yeah, but like the spaceships even move better. TIE fighters aren't supposed to move that good. Then you play the games and they're the most maneuverable things that you can fly. But whatever.
I just love the fact that we actually just created something that fits within the canonical continuity of the Matrix films that uses one of the only major complaints that people have about those films not looking right. And it actually fits. I think that's the best takeaway, talking about all this bullshit all the way up to this point. I'm very proud of that conclusion. I like it.
I mean, extra levels, I guess.
Damn. Yeah.
Yeah. that's a thing. Okay. Anyway. So the gist of what we're saying for the night, I'll sum up everything. Enjoy artificial intelligence created art at your own risk. If you believe it to be art, fine. Okay, then. Art's subjective. If you believe, whatever music you want to listen to is art, again, it's subjective. I still won't like you if you're a Nickelback fan, but that's okay. I don't have to like you. If your entire universe is wrapped up in whether I like you or not, you need to shift your priorities.
Nickelback went up a couple of extra rungs for me, especially in the realm of, Trapped and Smash Mouth and Five Finger Death Punch. Like, I'm just saying, those guys at least came out and had to make a statement about how not assholes they are. And yeah, of course they're Canadian. They're nice as hell, but that's regardless of the point.
Okay. But see, Nickelback fall under the same sin situation as, there's a few other artists, and I will, for the next podcast, I will do some research on this specifically. Nickelback's sins to the world at large, but specifically to the music industry, is not just the music that they made. Oh no, not just the music that they made. but is also the plethora of other bands that they found signed to different labels and got signed to different labels and helped them produce also shitty music.
Dude, okay, I want to say this because I was out at when we picked up the copy of bringing it back full circle real quick. We picked up the copy of Nightmare Before Christmas tonight over at Target, the Target exclusive. I was blown out because on the end cap of the vinyl aisle was a copy of the Avril Lavigne album Let Go on a Target color exclusive.
That's not even one of them that I'm talking about.
I know it's not because that wasn't until like 10 years after or something like that they got together. Are they still married? They're still married, right?
I care. no, just for anybody listening before next week's show, just go and watch the video for Porn Star Dancing. And when it sounds like a Nickelback song, which it will from the very beginning, wait till you get to like the second verse and it's even more of a Nickelback song. And somehow or another, they even got fucking Zach Wilde to be a part of that shit. Oh, I don't know how.
Don't forget Ludacris, man.
Huh?
Ludacris is in it too.
Yeah. But that is that band, that song, all Nickelback inspired. And trust me, watch the video. You'll see exactly why.
Oh yeah, definitely.
I remember that when that
top
video came on the first
man.
Time. First time that video came on, and I said to my wife, that sounds like a damn Nickelback song. No, it's not. And then you get to the second verse, she's like, oh, I fucking hate you. Like, yeah, you should.
That's good. Though.
Anyway, so Mike.
Yes.
Where can people have listened to your journey into Arthurian keyboarding and our concerns and maybe uplifting thoughts about artificial intelligence art?
Well, you can be checking us out on our website, thezenniochronicles.com or zenchron.com. If you don't want to type too much, you could also check us out on most major podcast platforms. We're also available on YouTube as well. Search for The Zennial Chronicles there. And if you're listening to us as a video on YouTube, please make sure to go down and click the like button. And then next to that, click the subscribe button. And then next to that, James, there's one more thing to do. What is that?
Click the bell.
I can't believe I just did that without stuttering. What the hell have I done?
You did that. You did that fucking amazing. And you also didn't do the whole also like multiple times.
Yeah.
You did fantastic.
I can't believe that. Where did that come from? I blacked out. What happened?
It was good.
Thank you.
It was good.
Yes. Make sure that you click the bell in order to get notified. What?
Wait.
What?
Was it you? Was it you?
I don't know.
Or was that AI Mike?
That's a good question. Something you need to learn about me, I guess. Yeah, make sure that you click the bell to get notified next time we have a video or podcast out or what have you. And I believe that's it for me. What about you, sir?
Well, as I already mentioned earlier in this, when Mike was talking about whatever he was talking about, it was some kind of music thing. He only alluded to it a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, Mike has another page on here on YouTube. He has actually two. First one is Ruling Note Music. This is where Mike talks about everything music related. He's working on a script right now. I don't remember what it's about, but you still want to check it out. See, I did some rhyming.
I like that. Yeah. I like that. That was good. That's perfect.
Also, there is Mike's page works on with his wife, Chronosode
yes.
Games. This is Mike and his wife playing video games. It was originally supposed to be in chronological order of the story, not of the release of the game. But now they're just playing video games and having fun doing so. And apparently, I'm assuming, getting slightly inebriated during the process of playing some of these games.
Well, that happens on Twitch.
Not
necessarily. Yeah, that happens on Twitch, not on our... Not on our YouTube page, but the YouTube page, we're still doing the chronological order stuff. So we're just in the middle of a weird.
Check out the Twitch
shift.
Thing, too, if you know what the hell that is, because you're younger than me and far more internet savvy.
Yeah, do it.
I don't know what that is.
Oh,
Twitch is some kind of weird dance when, like, you put a lit cigarette in your pocket and you're trying to put it out.
I
don't know.
I mean, have you done that, sir?
I've only smoked cigarettes like one time in my life. I hated it.
Was it because you put a lit cigarette in your pocket?
No, it was because it tastes nasty. I threw it on the ground.
It's fair. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you all for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Y'all have a good one.
Thank you for tuning in, friends. The journey continues next week.